Good morning, guten Tag, bonjour, welcome to Melting Pod, sound and colors from the planet Marseille to the January 20th, 2009, we are with the Saints. Especially hard for me to speak during Nights and Venice, my favorite song, but just a short intro to propose to you today an interview I recorded with Ed Cooper a long time ago in August 2007, but I never found a good time to publish it because there was always new things with Ed Cooper, his new album Gin Lee and the Yellow Dogs, and his European tours and the live interview with him at Berlin and Paris. And I think right now is a good time because, as you maybe know, the Saints reformed for a few shows at All Tomorrow's Party Festival in Australia with the original members Chris Bailey, Ed Cooper, Ivory, and they added Ashley Larissa at the bass. Propose to you to listen to that podcast in two parts because it's a long interview. We record almost 2 hours long with Ed Cooper. It was the first time we spoke really on the phone together, just after Peak City, this first reunion show with the Saints. In this first part, we spoke about that period at Brisbane when Ed met Chris and Ivor at school. The difficulties they met to play in their hometown. It's a little funny to speak about that right now because at Brisbane during the All Tomorrow's Parties Festival, they almost create a scandal because they didn't play their famous song I'm Stranded. The people were very, very angry. And 30 years ago, it was not the same. Nobody wanted to have the Saints in the club and they didn't want to compromise with a musical concept. It was very courageous until to self-produce and promote themselves their first album. You maybe already read or heard some part of that Saints history on other interviews, maybe on Melting Pod, but I would like to think there is something new in that podcast, especially a political background Ed share with us. It's interesting to cross with the music.
Yeah.
I want to speak with you about the first meeting with Chris at school when you were 14 years old?
Something like that, yeah. It was a long time ago.
Yes. But can you remember the first time you saw Chris at school?
I can't really. I mean, not the first. I can sort of remember the general time, but the very first meeting. No, I don't recall it that exactly. I think we sort of got to know each other because we were both often in trouble with the principal.
You were at the same classroom or only at the same school?
That's a good question. Well, all the classes were different, so I suppose we would have been in some of the same classes.
And you didn't remember the first time you saw his face?
not really.
And when did you have this idea to do to play music together?
It sort of happened by accident. I had been playing guitar and I was starting to write some songs. And I think I was talking about it a lot at school, sort of bragging about how good I was, I suppose. And at a party, there was this band playing and they weren't very good. And so a group of friends of mine who all had too much to drink kind of insisted that I should go up and play guitar, which I did, and sort of took over from where the band was. And then Chris jumped up and started singing, and Ivor came up and started playing piano. And so we did a couple of songs. And then the band kind of took their instruments away from us. Then nothing very much happened for a while. There was this other friend of mine, this American fellow who, this boy and his sister, who I became friends with. He was really the person that said, it sounded really great, you know, you should get Chris to be the singer. That's kind of how it happened. It took ages. I can't remember how long. You know, it was at least 6 months before we sort of started doing anything after that party. And it started very slowly with Ivor and Chris and myself. We started as a three-piece. We didn't have bass and we didn't have drums. We just basically rehearsed either in Chris's bedroom or in my parents' garage or in a shed at Ivor's mother's place. And yeah, it sort of slowly sort of developed. We started writing songs. I mean, I'd already written a couple, but it sort of developed in those early months, I suppose.
But the question was, I listened to the most primitive band in the world, and it's recorded in your parents' garage.
It was sort of it was the most convenient sort of space to work in, because everyone in Brisbane has cars and the yards are big enough and people have got garages and stuff like that. It was a much cheaper way of doing things. I mean, you didn't really have rehearsal rooms, professional rehearsal rooms, and they probably would have been expensive. So most of the time we just rehearsed either in the garage or in a bedroom. Maybe occasionally once we had drums, then we'd occasionally hire a hall to have a practice in.
Thank you.
remember where you gave the first show.
Where was the first show? That's a good question. Probably at a party. But once we started rehearsing, then people would come to the rehearsals anyway, so the rehearsals kind of became parties or became shows. It wasn't until much, much later that we sort of started a club ourselves, which lasted for about 6 months before the fire department and the health department closed us down because we didn't have enough toilets or fire escapes. But apart from that, we would also play at halls in the suburbs, just basically hire a hall and put on a show, print up some posters and put the posters up on the lampposts and hope people would turn up.
But I read that you make, like you explained, it was different, the explanation. They say that you organize free concerts and the people come and make the party.
Not free concerts, no. They weren't free. The concert, the shows that we did at our own club were always free. But if we put a show on in a hall, we'd always charge admission because it would cost us to hire the hall. It wasn't very much. It was a dollar or something. But, we did charge.
Because I read, some people say that it was you were communist. It was the first experience of communism.
No, I can't say that I was a communist, but we did play at the Communist Party functions a couple of times because we rehearsed in there, in their printing shop, and they let us do that for free. And in return for that, they got us to play at some of, I think one, maybe two, I can't really remember, there might have been two parties, but they didn't, I think it was only the one party, and then after that they didn't ask us again, so... But it was kind of, I guess it was a way of paying for the fact that they were letting us rehearse for free in their building.
You consider yourself as a communist at that moment, at that period?
Me? No, I don't think that I saw myself as a communist. I think I was more of an anarchist, if anything. I think the communists were sort of a little old-fashioned. I mean, it's a party that has a long history in Australia, but... I wasn't affiliated with any political party.
I read exactly that nobody wants to give you the possibility to play in the club because they say it's not music and you organize themselves your own show.
That's right. Yeah, we did all our own shows. We got booked to play once, and after that we were banned by the main booking agency in Brisbane. It was a music scene that was very closed, and it was basically all the venues were kind of controlled by one or two fairly powerful agents. They only put into those venues bands that were a certain type of band, and the Saints weren't that kind of band. Both in the way that we sounded, the fact that we played all original material, or if we played someone else's song, it didn't really sound like the original song. That was something that made the band quite distinct. I mean, a lot of my influences are really straightforward. I mean, I really liked 50s rock and roll. I liked Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry and Eddie Cochran and all those people, and you know, there's a clear influence and a lot of blues and soul, 60s soul music. It was never sort of an intention to try to sound like those versions. We were just playing those songs because that was the music that kind of inspired me. You know, what we did with them made them sort of quite distinctly our own as much as anything can kind of belong to one group. And so because we were doing that sort of thing, booking agents just wouldn't touch us. Plus, they didn't like us as people. They didn't like the audience that we had, which wasn't very big, but they didn't like them. All the bands that were playing, that were working a lot in Brisbane, were basically doing covers. They were doing what was on the top 40 or on the, you know, the top 20 album charts. So you'd have a lot of people playing Deep Purple, you'd have people doing Led Zeppelin or Alice Cooper, Status Quo, that kind of stuff. I mean, I quite like Alice Cooper, or I did in the early days, but we'd never play that sort of song just because it was on the charts. I mean, it would just be really stupid. It would go against the overall aesthetic of the band.
I'm ready.
What's that you say, girl? You did it all for me. Ability. Come on, it sounds so wrong when you say it. It sounds so wrong when you say I'm not playing your fool. But that's the story of love. What's that you say, girl? You did it all for me. Your ability. Come on, it sounds so wrong when you say it. It sounds so wrong when you say I'm not playing your fool. But that's the story of love.
Music at that moment already, because it's maybe hard to live in a country where nobody wants to recognize you as musician. That's why you self-produce.
Well, they certainly didn't recognize us as musicians, that's for sure. I am positive in making that claim. I mean, they generally, the attitude was that we were the worst band that had ever existed. So, we weren't taken seriously as musicians, but it wasn't easy to sort of dismiss the band either, because the band was so strong. So instead of just being able to write us off, they just basically hated us and banned us. So, it's funny looking back on those days, and I'm just glad that we kind of had the sort of drive to keep going, and oddly enough, it was fun. You know, it was actually good not to be liked by those people particularly. It was good that the reaction from people that we had no respect for absolutely despised us.
It's like the German in East Berlin at the period for the wall. I know bands who play rock and roll during the wall. It was really, they told me, it was really motivated for them to play their music because all the time the risk to be catched by the police because it was forbidden. Rock and roll was capitalist. Yeah. Yes.
I don't know if the repression here was quite as strong as that. I mean, in some ways, we had a number of shows that the police did break up, but it was more because of noise complaints. The police repression in Queensland, which became quite notorious, got worse after we left. When we were operating here, it was still kind of a lot easier to, you could just get away from it, if you know what I mean. It was just sort of, I mean, Brisbane is a, especially in those days, it wasn't a very big city population-wise, but it was a big area. And so there was a lot of space between places, and you could easily kind of get away from things. So we managed to put on a number of shows, and in fact, the club that we opened, which was in a house, was directly opposite the police cadet headquarters, and it wasn't the police that closed the club down, it was the fire department and the health department, so we didn't experience the absolute worst of what happened when Queensland became a sort of a police state. That happened after we left.
But you wrote that song, Brisbane Security City.
Yeah, I wrote that when I was in England, and I was living in London, and I was watching the news, and they had a broadcast from Brisbane, and there was a demonstration where people were protesting against the new law, which basically made street marches illegal. There would have been about, I don't know, 1,000 demonstrators and about 3,000 cops, and they'd brought police in from all over the state. The police outnumbered the demonstrators by about 3-1, and they got really aggressive, and they arrested about half of the crowd. And seeing that, sort of from the other side of the world, made me kind of just think back on the time that I lived here, and that's basically what inspired it. What I tried to do with that song, more than make a direct sort of political comment, was actually to capture a little bit of the atmosphere of the place, the heat, the quiet, and sort of a general sort of feeling of sort of growing paranoia, I suppose, if you were a young person or a person that was outside of sort of mainstream society.
Hard nights in a row. The cops drive past, but they move slow. A million people staying low. With mangoes ripe, good seeds to grow. Not the sound. the junk on the radio. Just take a look and you will know. I start to feel I'm being used in a scheme that's been hidden from the public view.
And we don't really live that in France too, but yeah, at the moment when I start my political demonstration, I already live that.
Right.
When the police beat you really in the face and you lost your teeth, by luck, I don't experiment that, but some people around me, yes, and it was not funny.
Yeah, I got punched by a cop once in the back of the head, and luckily, I was so drunk it didn't hurt at the time, but it did the next day. I think that the first demonstration that I went on, I went on a couple of the Vietnam moratorium marches when I was at school, and my main recollection of those were that they were almost, I mean, they were serious, but they were sort of almost parties, but the worst one, which was the first one that I went to, was a demonstration against the then South African rugby team, the Springboks, and in that one the police used horses and sort of pushed people over a fairly steep incline in this park, and I think I was about, I don't know, 14 or something when I went to that, and that was a bit scary, but that was the worst one that I personally experienced.
And you have police with horses in Australia?
Yeah, sure.
Oh la la. Luc Sarkozy, our president, don't know that. You know, only the...
Yeah, maybe you shouldn't advertise it.
Because, you know, already the policeman on motorcycle is quicker, it's faster to beat.
Right. Now, in those days, they used to use horses just basically a whole group of mounted police would sort of move onto a crowd, and because they were on horses, people that were just walking at a distinct disadvantage. And so they used mounted police to basically push people down this very steep hill off the road where they were. And the funny thing with the demonstrations here was that the demonstrators were never violent. I mean, they might throw a few things, but they never had Molotov cocktails or anything like that. It was always usually the violence would be started by the police. There'd never be a situation where that I can remember or I've even heard of where anything like that was done by demonstrators. Demonstrators, for the most part, were fairly peaceful. I was never particularly politically active in any way, but I did go on some of those marches. It was always, the band always came first, and,
But when you decide to self-produce your first album, it was a question for me. Where did you find the money to produce an album?
We did the first single, and we worked with a really good engineer, luckily, because we didn't really know very much about the process. It was kind of really good fortune that the the engineer that was working in the studio that we booked was really sympathetic and really helpful, and basically helped us through the whole process. It could have turned out really differently. I mean, given that what we were doing musically wasn't generally regarded very well, we could have got an engineer who just hated us and just, you know, not been helpful at all, but luckily that didn't happen. So after that, it was just a very quick learning curve. I mean, at that stage, no one in the band knew how to engineer, but I mean, the sound of the first record is what we sounded like live. It was just basically a matter of getting that sound. We kind of did. You know, we kind of did. I think possibly maybe the band sounded a bit better live. I'm not sure, but it was, you know, it was all recorded very quickly, and it sounded good to me at the time, sort of thing. So I was really happy with it.
1, 2, 3, 4. I'm making you crawl. I make your soul sad to a man. I make a song, and honey, I'm sure that you will play. I'm telling you, I don't let go until I'm through. I make you cry, I make you wish that you could die. I'm gonna be your damn ambition girl. Damn ambition girl, come on. I make you crawl, I make your soul set to a man. I make you stall, and honey, I'm sure that you have fun. I'm telling you, I don't let go until I do. I make you cry, I make you wish that you could die. I'm gonna be your damn ambition girl. Your damn ambition girl. Alright! I'll be your damn ambition. I'm gonna make you crawl. What I say.
And it was a time where you sent this single to London, and it was a success? Quickly?
I had a job in the public service at the time, and so I had a lot of free time. And one thing that I did was, on my extended lunch breaks, was go out and sort of buy any music newspaper or magazine that I could find, and just looked at the addresses and sent a record off to any newspaper or magazine that I thought might be appropriate. In a couple of cases, we got really good reviews. In some cases, we got really bad reviews. And looking back on that now, the amazing thing is that we got the number of reviews that we did, because normally, I mean, these days you can't just send something to a music paper and expect that they'll review it, because they get so much stuff in. And we were really lucky, because I didn't know any of the journalists, so it was just basically addressed to the newspaper with a, from memory, a handwritten letter just giving a brief history of the group and a photograph and the record. And so some of the reviews were really great, and sort of started to get things moving. We got a number of good reviews from England and from America, and mostly bad reviews in Australia at that time. But yeah, it was kind of a fairly straightforward thing to do, and it worked.
And how it was in London when you arrived at London at that moment?
Oh, London was sort of a funny combination of my impression of London was sort of, one, it's really big, there's a lot of people, because Brisbane was sort of like a country town.
You ask how I've been, but what's it to you? It's easy to see that you got someone new. If you wanna go, well baby, please do. I gave you my love, but you threw it away.
It's the end of this podcast, part one. In the second part, you will hear how the Saints arrive at London, in the punk movement explosion, and how they felt themselves misunderstood when the media stuck to the band and their music. A wrong image of punk band, which obviously didn't help to welcome their second album, Eternally Yours, and the third album, Prehistoric Sound. But I propose to you to listen to that later. You can write your comments and reaction on Melting Pod, www.meltingpod.com. Bye, tschüss, au revoir, à la prochaine fois, and stay connected with Melting Pod.
I don't know how long it's been since I felt that it's with you. Come on! You ask how I've been, but what's it to you? It's easy to see that you got someone new. If you wanna go, well baby please do. I gave you my love.